caring, persevering. Sail on, sail on, sail on.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Schutte.
And I'm Susan Schutte. As many listeners know, for the past several months, we've been following the voyage of the Plastiki, a catamaran constructed principally from recycled plastic water and soft drink bottles. Last week, the Plastiki landed in Sydney, Australia, after an 8,000 nautical mile voyage that started in San Francisco. We have twice interviewed Plastiki skipper Jo Royal, and we'll talk with her again tonight from dry land in Sydney.
Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-County's Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333. And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
And we'll take a short break and then give you some background on the voyage of the Plastiki.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, And tonight we're celebrating the arrival of the Plastiki, the ocean-going catamaran in Sydney, Australia. And we'll talk with Joe Royal in Australia. This project received radio coverage on NPR, and we saw video footage on ABC News with Diane Sawyer. Here's a news release that came out from the Plastiki project at 11:10 a.m. Sydney time, Monday, 26 July, 2010. The headline reads, "Message in a Bottle to Beat Waste Has Global Impact to Create Change." After sailing more than 8,000 nautical miles and spending 128 days crossing the Pacific in a boat made of 12,500 plastic PET bottles, P-E-T, that stands for polyethylene terephthalate, the stuff that plastic soda bottles are made of, the Plastiki expedition and her crew have safely and successfully reached their planned destination of Sydney to cheers of welcome and support.
Arriving at Sydney heads at 11:10 a.m. local time with a 12-knot south-southeasterly breeze, the Plastiki triumphantly sailed into Sydney Harbor to cheers of welcome and support from a small spectator flotilla. The historic expedition was completed in four legs: San Francisco to Kiribati to Western Samoa to New Caledonia before reaching the Australian coast at Mooloolaba on Monday, 19th of July, continuing on to Sydney.
The expedition leader, David de Rothschild, said, "It's an incredible feeling to finally arrive in Sydney. We had great faith in the design and construction of Plastiki, and while many people doubted we'd make it, we have proved that a boat made from plastic bottles can stand up to the harsh conditions of the Pacific."
De Rothschild also paid tribute to his fellow adventurers, Joe Royal, the skipper, David Thompson, the co-skipper, Graham Hill, founder of treehugger.com, Olaf Heyerdahl, the grandson of the Kon-Tiki rafter, Thor Heyerdahl, Matthew Gray, Luca Bobbini, the photographer, Vern Moen from Mayu Media Filmmaker, Max Jordan, and Singali Agnew from the National Geographic. Those last two are filmmakers from National Geographic, for their skill and commitment during the voyage. De Rothschild said, "Joe and the rest of the crew did a remarkable job sailing the Plastiki safely across the Pacific, and it is due to their collective efforts that we've been able to raise global awareness of the issue of plastic waste in the world's oceans."
To give us further perspective on the problem of plastic in the oceans, we'll quote from another source, Captain Charles Moore of the Algaeta Marine Research Foundation. He has written that plastic is drastic. He writes, "There is a large part of the Central Pacific Ocean that no one ever visits and only a few ever pass through. Sailors avoid it like the plague, for it lacks the wind they need to sail. Fishermen leave it alone because its lack of nutrients makes it an oceanic desert. This area includes the horse latitudes, where stock transporters in the age of sail got stuck, ran out of food and water, and had to jettison their horses and other livestock. Surprisingly, this is the largest ocean realm on our planet, being about the size of Africa, over 10 million square miles. Because of the stability of this gentle maelstrom, the largest uniform climactic feature on Earth is also an accumulator of the debris of civilization. Anything that floats, no matter where it comes from on the North Pacific Rim or ocean, ends up here, sometimes after drifting around the periphery for 12 years or more. Historically, this debris did not accumulate because it was eventually broken down by microorganisms into carbon dioxide and water." Now, the place that Captain Moore is describing here is called the Pacific Garbage Patch, where huge quantities of throwaway plastics accumulate, and the Plastiki expedition sailed quite close to it.
Captain Charles Moore continues, "Now, however, in our battle to store goods against natural deterioration, we have created a class of products that defeats even the most creative and insidious bacteria. They are plastics. Plastics are now virtually everywhere in our modern society. We drink out of them, eat off of them, sit on them, even drive in them. They're durable, lightweight, cheap, and can be made into virtually anything. But it is these useful properties of plastics which make them so harmful when they end up in the environment. plastics, like diamonds, are forever.
So if plastic doesn't biodegrade, what does it do? Captain Moore reports that it photodegrades, a process in which it is broken down by sunlight into smaller and smaller pieces, all of which are still plastic polymers, eventually becoming individual molecules of plastic, still too tough for anything to digest. He writes, in our research voyage out from Santa Barbara, we found everything from huge hawsers to tiny fragments forming into windrows that are hundreds of miles long. We picked up hundreds of pounds of netting of all types baled together in this system, along with every type and size of debris imaginable.
Captain Moore observes that sometimes the windrows drift down over the Hawaiian Islands. That is when the Waimanalo beach on Oahu gets coated with blue-green plastic sand, along with staggering amounts of larger debris. Farther to the northwest, at the northwestern Hawaiian Islands Coral Reef Ecosystem Reserve, monk seals, the most endangered mammal species in the United States, get entangled in the debris, especially cheap plastic nets lost or discarded by the fishing industry. 90% of Hawaiian green sea turtles nest here and eat the debris, mistaking it for their natural food, as do laizan and black-footed albatross. Indeed, the stomach contents of laizan albatross look like the cigarette lighter shelf at a convenience store that contains so many of them.
It's not just entanglement and indigestion that are problems caused by this plastic debris, Captain Moore writes. There is a darker side to pollution of the ocean by ubiquitous plastic fragments. As these fragments float around, they accumulate the poisons we manufacture for various purposes that are not water-soluble. It turns out that plastic polymers are sponges for DDT, PCBs, and nonylphenols, oily toxins that don't dissolve in seawater. Plastic pellets have been found to accumulate up to 1 million times the level of these poisons that are floating in the water itself. These are not like heavy metal poisons, which affect the animals that ingest them directly. Rather, they are what might be called second-generation toxics, and they have been shown to have a number of negative effects in everything from birds and fish to humans. The whole issue of hormone disruption is becoming one of, if not the biggest, environmental issues of the 21st century.
There's much more to Captain Moore's article, and we have posted the link on our website. He concludes that, I know when people think of deep blue ocean, they see images of pure, clean, unpolluted water. After we sampled the surface water in the Central Pacific, I often dive over with a snorkel and a small aquarium net. I have yet to come back after a 15-minute swim without plastic fragments for my collection. I can no longer see pristine images when I think of the briny deep.
And you can check out that article again, www.alguita.com. That's A-L-G-U-I-T-A. And we've posted the link on ecotopiakzfr.net. So that, in a nutshell, or in a PET bottle, is what the Plastiki trip was intended to publicize, the really horrifying quantity of plastic in the oceans and what it's doing to marine life and how it even poses a threat to humanity. We'll be back with Skipper Joe Royal right after this.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we are celebrating the arrival of Plastiki in Sydney. And with us on the phone from Sydney, Australia, is Skipper Jo Royal. She's an incredibly accomplished ocean sailor. We've had lovely conversations with her in our last chats with her. And she's in Skipper, the only all-female team in a two-person transatlantic race. She's also an environmentalist. She's done graduate work in environmental science and society at the University of Central London. Jo, it's really nice to have you back. How are you?
You're welcome.
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, very well.
You. Tell us,
I'm enjoying dry land.
I bet you are. We have some questions about that.
So you're in Sydney at the moment. Are you out near the harbour having a look? Where are you?
Well, the boats are docked outside the Australian Maritime Museum, which is in Sydney.
Yes, okay.
And so we just sat outside there.
Nice.
It's the middle of winter, though, so I'm looking forward to being back in California in the sunshine.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, in the first part of the interview tonight, we thought we'd just ask you to talk about the adventure of your trip. Was it fantastic or what?
It was awesome. It was incredible to spend 4 months floating around the Pacific, traveling very, very slowly, and spending every single day, I suppose, responding to whatever Mother Nature decided to throw at us that day. So that was an incredible experience, a very humbling experience, obviously.
So how did the Plastiki perform? We saw it when it was in development, and it's just, and we've, of course, watched it on the website, how it's developed. So how did it do?
Well, she likes strong winds and to travel downwind. She hates going upwind. She finds it impossible. And there's a lot of sideways crabbing because we don't have any kind of dagger boards or nothing in the water to keep us on the rails. So she goes sideways quite a lot. So, but in the strong wind, she's great. In light wind, it's kind of like rowing on the helm.
Oh, no.
Kind of lots of pushing the helm around to try and just keep her totally on course, which is very, it's been difficult at times. She kind of rears up into an accidental jibe and she's facing the wrong way and it takes ages to turn her back round and get her on track again. So she's been a challenge, but fun.
And solid.
Would that be true of all ocean-going catamarans, or was it characteristic of the design, including your recycled bottles?
It was characteristic of the design, because we really wanted the bottles to be not only intrinsic to the design of the boat, which they are, they provide 90% of the buoyancy of the boat, but we also wanted them to be visual, so that people could really, we could all really visualize why we were building the Plastiki and why we were sailing her across the Pacific.
So did it feel really stable, though? I mean, it felt really reliable and...
Yeah, I mean, it was, I suppose the most daunting part of the expedition was leaving the Golden Gate Bridge on a boat that was built out of a material that had never been tested.
Uh-huh.
And we were all very aware of this. And there were two, myself and another experienced sailor on board. And normally you're very used to seeing how your boat wears over the course of a long journey. But with the material that we used to build the boat, we didn't know...
Right.
Really what to expect and what to look for. So it was like living, the boat was built to move. It was built with the two hulls were tied to the central bit where the cabin was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen, I think I know you've seen the boat, but I don't know if other people have seen it on the website. But it's kind of raft-like. So it was built to move. So it's like living in the land. In England, we used to have a soft mint advert where everyone lived on this land of the soft. And it was definitely living on a very wobbly, flexible surface. But it was... But it moved very nicely with the ocean,
uh-huh.
So it wasn't violent at all. It was actually a kind motion to be living on.
Very nice. And what was the route that you followed? You went from San Francisco south to San Diego and then headed off into the deep blue from there?
Well, actually, we followed the route of the Plastiki, whatever she wished to do. We went with her. We tried to have this route all mapped out, and then we realized that it wasn't going to be that easy to pinpoint these tiny little specks in the ocean, and that actually we'd sail kind of the most direct Plastiki route towards Sydney, which ended up being quite similar to the route we'd mapped out. We set off from the Golden Gate Bridge on the 20th of March. That was just over 4 months ago, and we sailed with the first stop, thinking that we could stop along the coast of California if we had any problems, or if we felt the boat was great, then we could continue on towards the Line Islands. And we had no issues. We had some big, big weather the week after we set off, which really meant that it tested the boat and the crew.
Yeah.
We felt very confident. So off we set for our first long leg, which was 4,000 miles and 40 days at sea. So it was a long time spent at sea for anybody, let alone people that had never, if four of the guys had never spent more than a night at sea, two of the guys had never spent a night at sea. So it was a great adventure for them.
So how were the living quarters for everybody on board? Did that end up feeling pretty comfortable, or did people like claw each other's eyes out or anything?
No, we had no major arguments. I think actually our main argument was on the first leg, and it was kind of 30 days into the first leg when someone had eaten all the jam. One of the guys was very discomfort that somebody had eaten all the jam. So it's very petty things that get under your skin when you're trying to live for long periods of time in a very confined space.
Mm-hmm.
But the boats run on a 24-hour system, obviously, watch system. So there's half the crew are having time off while half the crew are on deck running the boats. So it meant that mainly there was only ever three people kind of wanting to, you know, cook, clean, wash, sleep in the cabin at once, and the other three would be on deck working the boats.
Right.
I was listening to on National Public Radio about a week ago, Ira Flatow was interviewing a guy who had walked to the South Pole, spent 56 days, as I recall. And one of Ira's question was, did you get claustrophobic, meaning on the way to the South Pole, there was just no place to go? You pitch your tent at night, and there you are. And I was thinking of the Plastiki. It must be a somewhat similar feeling. There's just no place to, I mean, suppose you could jump off and have a swim, but that's about as far as you could get away from the boat.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, you're in this vast, vast wilderness. So you're in the widest open space that you could possibly, really, that you could ever put yourself in. Mm-hmm. Yet you're confined to this 60-foot by 20-foot platform. And I think that if you let your head enter that headspace of feeling claustrophobic or bored or lonely, then you could quickly run away with those thoughts. But but you know, the ocean is forever changing. The sky's ever changing. Mm-hmm. Every night there's incredible stars that you would never, you get to see in the middle of the desert or in the middle of an ocean, and it's just they're all such awesome changing sights that it's very difficult to feel trapped.
Yes.
I personally find, and I think we all found that. I think at the end, you know, the first leg was definitely a challenge for everybody, and it was definitely felt like the biggest adventure, because at one stage we were 2,000 miles away from anywhere, which really felt on a boat that we built and reliant on buoyancy of 12,000 plastic bottles. And there was one night when we'd have a kind of brief on what the weather strategy was and, you know, how the boat was going every night. And it was one night we were like, oh, so we're 2,000 miles from anywhere. I think our strategy right now is not to do anything stupid and just to be safe and enjoy being in the middle of being the most remote we'll probably ever be in our lives.
Right.
And so that's pretty awesome.
How would you compare? You've always sailed the Atlantic before this trip, isn't that right? I think I remember you saying
that. Yeah, mainly in the Atlantic,
right, and kind of other seas in that direction, whichever direction, west, east, from wherever you are. But how would you compare your other ocean skippering with this experience?
Well, the Pacific is vast.
Yes.
And it feels vast.
Uh-huh.
It's a third of the surface of the planet, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We did a route that was from San Francisco to Sydney, so we passed through two hemispheres, almost in a direct line. We passed passed across lots of different ocean currents and lots of different sea mounts, and we experienced various sea states. You know, depending on what part of the ocean we were in, and we saw different seabirds. The Atlantic's a lot smaller, and the weather systems are a lot different. The Pacific is meant to be the peaceful ocean. Because it's so vast, the weather systems seem to be more stable, and that was definitely my experience of the Pacific Ocean.
Interesting.
But also, we hardly saw any wildlife, which shocked us all. In the Atlantic, even recently, you know, I've crossed the Atlantic and seen a lot of dolphins and a lot of jellyfish and also and marlin and big fish.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Pacific, we saw, in 4 months at sea, until we reached the coast of Australia, where it's humpback migratory season, so that was so lots of humpbacks, which is incredible.
Mm, cool.
Until we reached the coast, we just saw a pod of pilot whales and a couple of pods of dolphin and three tuna. And we were like, oh, what? Why is this? Is it really because our oceans are barren? Have we really fished out all the fish? Or is it because, the Pacific is vast and marine life likes to live close to shore or where the sea mounts or upwellings or continental shelves? And when you're crossing the Atlantic, you spend a lot more time nearer those, those topography.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Do you have a tentative answer to that? Is it the vastness that led to the scarcity, or do you have reason to believe ocean pollution might be having those effects?
I think it's both, and I'm not a scientist, and I've not spent my whole life crossing the Pacific, so I think there are big, grandiose conclusions to come to.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's not because we've taken all the fish from the ocean, but evidence and there's proof into how many fish we do take, and also the toxicity that we put into the ocean. I think it's I'm 100% sure that it affects.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that is a reason why we saw less marine life.
Mm-hmm.
When we interviewed you before you left, we talked some about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the Gyre. I think I read on the blog that you went close to it, but you didn't choose to venture into it. Could you talk about how close did you get, and what traces were, what evidence did you see of it?
When we were nearer to stopovers and close to the shores of California and Australia, we saw larger items of marine debris. And then when we swam off the boat, we saw finer particles of marine debris throughout the trip. Finer particles, not marine debris, of plastic in the ocean. As at the beginning, when the plasticky first became an idea, it was very focused on the Pacific Gyre, mm-hmm. which is that big vortex in the Pacific where two ocean currents meet, and they're acting as like a whirlpool that pulls in all the trash from the North Pacific Rim. And then we realized that a lot of the focus on ocean pollution was particularly on this Gyre, this one geographical area that was huge. It's 200,000 square kilometers, so it's absolutely vast. But it was almost like pollution could be geographically bound. But unfortunately, environmental change isn't geographically bound, and one country's problem or one area's problem is definitely the rest of the world's problem. And as time went on, we really wanted to spread our focus to oceans in general. There's actually five gyres in the world that we know about at the moment. There's two in the Pacific, and there's one in the Atlantic and two in the Indian Ocean. And I think to have that one, so then we decided to focus on the oceans in general and really focus on to learn more about how plastic photodegrades, how it never really disappears. And we definitely saw evidence of this.
Right. So you had some filmmakers on board. You had National Geographic filmmakers, and then I think you had another filmmaker. There are specific plans for how the films will be made or what will be done?
Yep, National Geographic are going to produce a two-hour documentary on the build of the Plastiki and on the expedition. And then also we're working on a feature film on documentary on plastic in general and plastic is ubiquitous to our life and how we can use plastic in a smarter way.
So is that going to be National Geographic as well, or is some other
filmmaker that's a filmmaker, but the National Geographic film should be out in the beginning of next year when Max, the filmmaker, regains his sanity and edits all these hours of ocean footage.
Oh, yeah.
So you said that there was a big storm early on, and I wondered, did you have scary moments? I mean, were there times when you went, oh, boy, hold on?
I think we had lots of moments where we were very acutely aware of where we are and how precious the situation we were in was. we had a lot of bad weather in the Tasman Sea. It took a little longer than we expected to cross the Pacific, and obviously, and now we entered Australia in the winter, well, southern Australia in their winter. So we had some really huge, I mean, one night we had 62 knots, which is kind of 8 knots below a hurricane.
Oh, my gosh.
So we certainly had fun and games, and it was great in a way that the weather, I mean, I love spend time in the ocean, so I love to see the weather change.
Right.
But it was great to see, you know, to have these really intense high winds come through towards the end of our journey when the team and the crew had really pulled together and understood the boat, and we were confident with the boat, although she was definitely ready for a break as, as the rest of us.
And where is the Plastiki now, and what is its future?
So she's going to stay in the National Maritime Museum in Sydney for 6 weeks, and then she's on to her next. She's going to, I think she's going to go to Hong Kong. We're just deciding what she's going to do at the moment.
Oh, wow.
And she'll carry on raising awareness of marine plastic and pollution, and also environmental issues such as ghost netting and overfishing and toxicity as well.
Why don't we take just a short break? We've asked you mostly about the adventure part. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about environmental issues in just a moment. We're talking with Joe Royal, the skipper of the Plastiki, which has arrived safely in Sydney, Australia. State artist Dick and Jane going to Australia, and we're on the phone to Australia, Sydney, Australia, with Joe Royal, skipper of the Plastiki, constructed from 12,000 recycled plastic bottles. She and the crew sailed 8,000 nautical miles in 128 days, San Francisco to Sydney, a long haul. Joe, you've studied environmental science, and we know you're committed to the concept of science and society and where they meet. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the science. You've talked a bit about the plastic residue you've seen in the ocean. Could you tell us more about what you observed from the platform of the Plastiki?
I think after spending 4 months sat in the middle of the Pacific, I really reconfirmed to myself that at the end of the day, we're all sea creatures. And no matter where we are in the world, whether we're in Central Valley or in San Francisco Bay, our life support system is the ocean. I mean, 80% of the air that we breathe is generated from the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And the ocean absorbs more of the heat generated from climate change than the atmosphere does. It's really, you know, and the list, you know, its benefits are endless. It provides, one in four people rely on their main source of protein from the ocean. And and I think that we've become very disconnected from this fact. So that was definitely, that's something that I've become really acutely aware of, that the connection that we need to have with nature, that a lot of your listeners do have from all the farming and around, you know, around Chico.
Mm-hmm.
So we all learned that, and we've all stepped back on shore feeling very empowered from that experience.
Nice.
I think we also learned that about the photodegrading of plastic and about the dumb use of one life plastic, because 60% of the plastic that we see that's consumer driven in the ocean comes from these four types of plastic: the plastic bag, the drinks bottle, the mm-hmm. drinks bottle top, the cap, uh-huh. and styrofoam containers,
right.
which are all items of plastic that we don't need in our right. everyday life. And San Francisco's banned the plastic bag. The state of California are working on banning the plastic bag at the moment.
Right.
When Washington banned the plastic bag, didn't they? When did they ban the plastic bag? Recently. They banned it. They went from using 300 million bags a month, 300 million to 2 million.
Wow.
In such a short space of time. And that was just by adding a 5-cent tax on the bag. The styrofoam is not needed, and it's extremely right. toxic, especially if you're using it to carry food in. And the plastic water bottle and the bottle and the lid are currently, and not needed at all. So that we could stop that kind of one life use of plastic at source right now.
So you say you came back empowered. Are you feeling that we can reverse this process, that we can help the ocean at all, but can we change people so that they see that we don't need these things? We have many alternatives, really. So do you think are you optimistic?
Yeah, of course. I think we live at a really exciting time. I mean, the ocean's beautiful. It's still alive. It's still providing us our life support system, and it's going to continue. The only side of the partnership that's at risk is the human race. Mm-hmm. And I think that we do feel empowered, and I think the Plastiki actually has worked at connecting people with the ocean through the expedition. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have come to us and said, and have started their own Plastiki campaigns, banning bottled water in their schools.
Mm-hmm.
Or, and I think we live at a time where we can all feel very energized, and also at a time where we all realize that no one's as smart as everyone, and it's time to come together and start our own campaigns to really take action. I feel that over the past 5 years, the environmental space has created a lot of noise, mm-hmm. which has really got people, energized. And now I think it's a time where we put all that noise and all that effort into actually seeing action, and that's got to come from everybody from the bottom down as well as legislatively, which we're starting to see more and more of.
What are your expectations about legislation generally? We keep asking on this show whether legislation will do it, or whether it's up to people of goodwill, whether there need to be incentives, and it's hard to see how plastic in the ocean can be regulated. You can do it at the source, I guess, but what are your observations on the mechanisms, legal versus the goodwill of humankind?
I think it's the goodwill and the collective and the collaboration that's going to motivate legislation, and that's what we're experiencing now. I also think that legislation, I mean, we carried a memorandum from San Francisco to Sydney,
mm-hmm.
About creating more laws around the use of one life plastic.
Okay.
But it's so complex to get legislation passed through the bureaucratic systems that are in place,
mm-hmm.
especially in Australia than in California. But I think it's people coming together and motivating their senates and to put legislation in place. I also think it's important that we think about not just legislating against, and obviously a lot of plastic can be stopped at source.
Right.
But also I think that I do actually believe that in our lifetime plastic has become ubiquitous, and certain objects are going to be made from plastic, the day that we pass on. But I think what is important and what I would love to see more of is smart manufacturing, is to really think, okay, well, this item, my laptop, for instance, it's more practical that it's in plastic than it's in wood, but why does it have to be a real, really toxic one-life plastic?
Mm-hmm,
why
mm-hmm.
can't we think about using a plastic that is low toxicity and highly recyclable? So say that everything that's made from plastic has an afterlife, and therefore we're creating a value for plastic, like we have done with aluminium, which means that it doesn't want, it's stupid to put it in the ocean because it's got a value and it's economically viable to recycle it. And I think we need to move forward in smart manufacturing as well as legislating against single-use plastics.
So at your various ports of call along the way and when you arrived in Sydney, were you able to get the message out there? Did you? What kind of response did you get from people that you stopped to see along the way?
I think we learned as much as we gave in the stopovers. In Christmas Island, which is our first stopover, which is in the south of the Line Islands. It's about 1,300 miles south of Hawaii. There's very little use of One Life plastic.
Nice. Okay.
Unfortunately, they've just started to get water in plastic bags, and obviously they end up near the ocean. But we learned a lot about living off the ocean, and also shared our stories about single-use plastic, which was really beneficial to both us and people that we met on Christmas Island. In Western Samoa, they have a great recycling system, and they have a levy on bottles, which really create, give bottles an economical value. So that was great to see. And in Sydney, our arrival was incredible. We had hundreds of boats hundreds of people and lots of boats and coming to meet us, everyone. And so I've met so many people. We've been into schools who have banned bottled water and put in water fountains, and we've been to areas that stop the use of plastic bags, and everyone's really got their own plasticky going, which is resulting in lots of action. So it's been
great. Right. Zillions of things happened to you in the last several months. What are some of the highlights for you now as you think back on the last 4, 5, 6? Well, you've been really involved with this process for a year, maybe more, a year and a half, maybe?
Yeah, nearly 2 years, yeah.
2 years, right, okay. So what are some of the highlights as you think back on that 2 years?
Definitely, I still have fond memories of being in the pier in San Francisco where we built the boats, and just being with a fairly small team of people that were certainly not experts in boat building and certainly not experts in using the material that we actually built the boat in. I don't know if I've made it clear, but the boat's buoyant on 12,000 plastic water bottles, but the actual material, the superstructure of the boat, is actually made, it's the same plastic as the 2 liter plastic water bottle, which is PET. Mm-hmm. So it's highly recyclable and very low toxicity. And the idea was that the whole boat can be recycled, and we're kind of providing a solution to that One Life plastic that ends up in landfill. So actually discovering the material and testing it and working out how to use it and coming together from all different backgrounds. Some one guy was an engineer, never been to sea. One guy, was a cabinet maker, and all these different, and two guys are plastics experts, and all these different people coming together and actually building a boat that made it across the Pacific really taught us all that no one's as smart as everyone, and that if you come together with a lot of passion and motivation and able to stick at it, certainly needed to stick at it at times, then we're really living in a wonderful time of life where you can make a change really quickly.
You mentioned that the plasticky may go on to Hong Kong. Could you tell us a little bit about future plans, both for the plasticky project and for you personally?
Yeah. The plasticky is going to become an oceans exhibit. And at the moment, there's no plans for her to continue on sailing.
Right.
But who knows? Hopefully in the future she will.
Okay.
And I will continue on sailing to raise awareness of various different environmental issues. And hopefully my next adventure will be in the Arctic. Looking in the Barents Sea and looking at, there's a lot of some nuclear submarines that are decaying up there, and just trying to investigate how to get rid of how to stop toxic leaching from decaying ships up in the Barents Sea.
We've already
interviewed. It was incredibly hot in terms of the exhibition. We had 100 degrees on the boat.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
In the cabin. It was so hot. It was, I think that was the most challenging part of the trip, was crossing the equator and being stuck in that small cabin, baking. And so I'm looking forward to some high-latitude sailing where I can dress in lots of warm clothes. Mm-hmm.
You're already the most interviewed person on our little Ecotopia show here. Obviously, this is going to continue. We'll have to keep calling you up as you have one adventure,
yeah.
One productive Ecotopian adventure after another. That sounds terrific.
That would be great.
You're an inspiring woman.
Oh, thank you. I think that everyone is inspiring at the moment.
Well, we want to thank you, Joe, for talking with us tonight. Folks, be sure to check out the Plastiki website. It includes photos, videos of the expedition. There's Joe's own blog, which we read from a couple weeks ago, and information on how you can contribute to the campaign there at www.theplastiki.com. Thank you, Joe Royal. Really looking forward to seeing you again stateside when you're done being down under. Thanks for being
Give us a call when you get home.
I'm really looking forward to coming back to California.
Great.
Okay, thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.
Good night.
Bye.
I'm here to talk to you about what we can do for planet Earth. And it goes a little something like this. Check it out. Trash can wrapped in, we're here to say. That's how you should throw your garbage away. But throw it in the sea or on the dam. Do the right thing and throw it in the can.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Yeah. Polluting our lands, yo, lakes and seas. You know what they're doing to our trees? They're cutting them down to the ground, making more factories in our town. Stop pollution, stop pollution, stop pollution, stop, 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 stop. Pollution, stop pollution, stop pollution, stop.
Trash can wrap, trash can wrap.
You wanna know something that's really a drag? It's using those plastic garbage bags. Plastic is no good for this atmosphere. It won't break down for a few hundred years. So when you're out shopping at the store and they offer you a bag, say no more. Bring your own bag. Bring your own bag. Bring your own bag.
No thank you, I have my own bag. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
You wanna know something that's really cool, man? You can recycle your aluminum soda can. Recycle your paper cans and trash. It's a really easy way to make some extra cash. Recycle. Recycle.
Recycle.
Reduce. Reuse. Recycle.
Trash can wrap.
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 Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap.
It's just sitting there collecting dust and dirt. It's leaking oil and other fluids. The tires are going flat. Maybe it's time the old clunker in your life needs to move on. And donate it to Community Radio 90.1 FM KZFR. It's tax deductible. Must have an engine, be towable, and you must have the pink slip. We'll take your boat, truck, farm equipment, or RV, too. Call 1-888-KZFR-AUTO. That's 1-888-593-7288.
We've been talking tonight about pollution through plastics in the ocean, and a little bit earlier we read to you about the damage being done to the Laysan albatross by plastic particles and plastic molecules. We want to dip into our old English lit anthology and remind you of another albatross and read a bit from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, written in 1798. You probably remember the plot line from your English lit classes. A man is on the way to a wedding, and he is seized by a guy he calls a gray-beard loon. This is the Ancient Mariner, disheveled, ratty, who insists on telling his story to the wedding guest. And the story is of a trip into the land of ice and snow. The mariner says, "Our ship was cheered, the harbor cleared. Merrily did we drop below the kirk, below the hill, below the lighthouse top. The sun came up upon the left, out of the sun sea came he, and he shone bright, and on the right went down into the sea," which, as they teach us in English lit class, means they were heading south toward the land of ice. "The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled like noises in a swound. At length did cross an albatross. Through the fog it came, as if it had been a Christian soul. We hailed it in God's name. It ate the food it had never had eat, and round it flew. The ice did split, and with a thunder fit the helmsman steered us through. And a good south wind sprang up behind. The albatross did follow, and every day for food or play came to the mariner's hello. In mist or shroud, on mast or shroud, it perched for vespers nine, whilst all the night through fog, smoke, white, glimmered the white moonshine." The wedding guest says, "God save the ancient mariner from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why lookest thou so?" And the mariner says, "With my crossbow I shot the albatross." And he says, "The sun now rose upon the right. Out of the sea came he, still hid in mist, and on the left went down into the sea. The wind drops out, dropped down the breeze, the sails dropped down. 'Twas sad as sad could be, and we did only speak to break the silence of the sea. Ah, well-a-day, what evil looks had I from old and young. Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung." And so the sailor's luck absolutely deserts them with the death of the albatross. And there's a painful moral there. Do not shoot the albatross. And the albatross in our time does represent the oceans that Joe Royal has talked about so articulately tonight. We can't afford to fill them with plastic. We cannot kill the albatross.
And that's it for tonight's Ecotopia. Join us next week when Jeff Inslee and I will be talking with North State Master Gardeners, including Jennifer Jewell and David Grau, about getting started with the fall planting season. And 2 weeks from tonight on Ecotopia, we'll be interviewing author Doug Abrams. He's a novelist and has written a book called Eye of the Whale about threats to the whale population. He's also an environmentalist and will talk to us about a range of issues, including ocean pollution. And we want to remind you that Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
And we also want to alert you to a very special Ecotopia coming up on August 24th. It will be our 100th Ecotopia show. And for the evening, we have contacted Ernest Kallenbach, the author of the original novel Ecotopia. We'll be traveling to Oakland a little bit later next week. We will interview Ernest Kallenbach at his home in Berkeley, and we'll play that interview for you that evening. We'll ask him what he was thinking when he composed Ecotopia and what he's thinking and worrying about now.
Coming up at 7 this evening is The Storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, bringing you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures. Join Adrian for a trip around the world, exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people.
And then at 7:30, it's All Mixed Up, bringing you 2.5 hours of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music, blurring the boundaries of most commercial radio. Stay tuned and enjoy listening to a world that is all mixed up.
Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy.
I'm Stephen Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. And you can also become our friend on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Good night.
Good night.
Shine on me again now. Fill it again now. Help you to find your new tomorrow. Shine on.